I'll just share a little bit about Leo, who spent his career at Wisconsin, which is my alma mater, and so I feel great about that. He was the soil fertility person there, both extension and research. In the true spirit of the land grant, he worked with producers and industry and labs to get them to all work together, and was instrumental in forming the Wisconsin Fertilizer and Chemical Association, which has continued to help those groups to work together. He was so successful that they made him chair and then dean, and he had a long list of accomplishments in those roles. So thank you very much, Leo, for getting this kicked off. It is my pleasure to introduce our 2015 Walsh lecturer, Bill Pan. He's from Washington State University. I first came to know Bill through his published work. I was on the opposite side of the country. I was studying nitrogen management on wheat, and much of the best work at that time was being done by Bill Pan. He was already working, and this is a long time ago, remember, when I was a graduate student. He was already working on spatial variability, landscape effects, nitrogen efficiency, and nitrogen timing. And my view is that he was ahead of his time on many of these issues. More and more people are working on these things that he was a pioneer in. And that's why we invited him. It's really that kind of thought process. He has a long list of accomplishments that I could tell you about and that were written up in a bio form. And those are also part of why we invited him, but I'm not going to give you the list. I'm just going to tell you that it really came down to who we thought could present a good message, a good communicator, someone with wisdom and perspective. And we had a lot of names in our hat, but Bill was the one we chose. And I will also point out that he will be our first Walsh lecturer to come from the West Coast, and I think there's real value in that perspective. So I present to you Bill Pan to talk to us about the roots of soil fertility.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you and the selection committee for bestowing this great honor to me. I never would have dreamed, really. They kind of plucked me out of semi-obscurity up there in the Pacific Northwest, and so I didn't think anybody was really paying any attention to what we were doing. But sometimes, I guess with free access now, maybe people are kind of catching up to what we've been doing. Anyway, thanks to Peter, the committee, the division, and Carrie and Josh for inviting me to deliver this. And I thought about that challenge of trying to find somebody that's accumulated enough wisdom and yet is not on the downhill enough to lose all that wisdom. So there's a real fine kind of diminishing return. Well, I'll get into that in a minute. So I thought, well, by the end of the day, you're all pretty well data saturated and thought saturated, and your eyes are all blurry like I am usually by this time of the day in the meeting. So I thought I'd make it a little strong on stories and concepts and just a few, like 10 data slides, and kind of weave connections of history and principles and how it will help us guide us into the future and give some thought to what might be interesting and thoughtful to our next generation, which is to look at this crowd and look at the diversity of age and gender and ethnicity. It's really awesome to see, because we didn't have this kind of diversity when I first started attending these meetings back in the early 80s, so it's really terrific to see. Anyway, I better get on it, because as people know, in my group, I tend to wander, and then I'm on like slide 5, and they say, well, you got 3 minutes. So let's get on with it. So just to review again what I hope to cover is my personal roots. Actually, mentioning in the business meeting, trying to connect the societies to the local community and city that the meeting is, and I've got something to add there, so that'll be pretty interesting for you, I think, relative to Minnesota and Minneapolis. And then talking about the land grants and to Dr. Walsh, thank you, Dr. Walsh, for setting up this lectureship, and it's just really kind of kismet how this has all come together for me in this location and on behalf of Dr. Walsh, so I'll explain that in the next few slides. But so I want to talk about that, the kind of the historical roots and applications of just some of the basic laws and principles of soil fertility. You know, we have some basic laws, and actually when you think of all of soil science, there aren't that many laws, right? But we've got some of them. So we want to be proud of those laws and honor them and apply them. And then talking about the connection between soil fertility and plant physiology, and that, of course, happens at the root. So I'll talk a little bit about our work on roots in connection with the soil fertility research, and then talk a little bit about my thoughts about future roots. I've got a long list of folks here that I want to credit for recent collaborations of stuff I'm going to talk about, and a much longer list that's not even on here of people that I've enjoyed working with over the years. Many that aren't on this list are actually encompassed in the three projects that are down listed below, which are the NSPIRE NSF IGERD program that we've been honored to host for the last 4 or 5 years, and it's been training graduate students across the nexus of nitrogen science and policy. It's been an awesome program. And then the REACH program, we were lucky enough to land one of these big CAP projects on climate change, one of the three in the country in the Pacific Northwest across Idaho, Washington, Oregon. And we've been able to do a lot of great cropping systems related work related to our concerns with climate change. And then the third one is more of a local one at the state level of the Energy Freedom Act, kind of funneled federal money through the states to look at bioenergy. And we had our own version of that and looking at oil seeds, the potential for oil seeds integrated into our wheat-dominated systems in the inland Pacific Northwest. So we'll talk about some of those related projects as we move forward here. But I wanted to start with my own family history since we're here in Minneapolis. Because this is where it all kind of started for us as a family, both on my mom's side and my dad's side. So this was a calendar from 1999 that the University of Minnesota put together. And lo and behold, here's my grandfather. And so he played soccer for them. He had come over from Beijing, China for the first time. So I thought I'd tell this story because of all the talk about immigration and, you know, all the weird stuff going on right now. It's like, well, let's all remember where we came from. We're all immigrants, right? So I'm going to tell this story a little bit. This is my grandfather. He got a scholarship from the U.S. government because of war reparations. U.S. was at war with China at the time. And so they provided some bright students with scholarships to come over, and my grandfather, from all accounts, was kind of a stud. He was smart, and he was athletic, and he won an Olympic medal in the Asian Olympics for the decathlon. He came over and played soccer, and he studied mining engineering. He and his brother came over at the same time, so they were the first two Asian students at the University of Minnesota. So imagine that. So I thought I'd better tell part of his remaining story, which was after he got out of college and had that mining degree, he went up further north here to Hibbing, Minnesota. And those of you who know the landscape here know that as the Iron Range, where all of the iron ore was mined out of the ground, put on barges in the Great Lakes and shipping down to the steel mills of Ohio and Pennsylvania. So it was really kind of fueling the Industrial Revolution of the United States in the mid-20th century. And so here he was, engineer, kind of running some of the show of mining all this rich ore. And at age 6, we'd go up and visit him up in Hibbing, also the birthplace of Bob Dylan. So whenever you think you hear a Bob Dylan song, just think of this story. And so my first soil science term that I learned was the word hematite. And he showed me samples. We went out on this great hole that they dug out of the ground. They called it the Mini Grand Canyon. It was just humongous. And I don't know if they could do that these days with environmental restrictions, but I've been told by somebody that lives up there now that several of these big holes in the ground that have been filled up with crystal clear water now, and they're great places to scuba dive. So it's not all bad for the environment. So that was a picture back in 1906, just about 8 years before my, or 10, 8 years before my grandfather arrived. And so here's a picture of, it didn't actually capture the whole range of the company. Hibbing was a mining town run by the Oliver Mining Company. And here's my grandfather sitting up in front, right up in front, looking like he owns the joint. And here's another picture of him downtown surveying. Now, why is he surveying the town? Well, they discovered that Hibbing was right over the next big ore vein that they needed to mine. And so he was in charge of surveying the land and then making some recommendations for the town to move. Now, not everybody, as you might imagine, really was real happy with having to move. And so because you can see the big smile on my grandfather's face, and that's so rare to see somebody smiling in a picture from that era. And I think it was that demeanor that encouraged the owners of Oliver Mining to have him as kind of the PR guy, that he had to kind of convince the town that it would be good for them in the long run to move their houses. Okay, so that set the legacy for our connection, our family connection with the University of Minnesota. We had Grandpa, both my parents. I have a couple of siblings that attended University of Minnesota, aunts, uncles, and cousins, all attended University of Minnesota. But and so I spent my early life here. I was actually born a few miles from here. My mom and dad were wed at the Presbyterian, that beautiful Presbyterian church that's real close to the Hyatt Regency. And so I was baptized at that church as well. So a lot of connections. And then I can tell you about my mom's side, which I'll just briefly, because I got to move on. But they came in by more conventional means, came through immigration in San Francisco, set up the more typical thing of a Chinese restaurant, a Chinese food store, and a noodle factory. And I was able to visit some of that. Well, not the restaurant. The restaurant had been sold out by that time, but the noodle factory was still there. And so now, if you want to visit where my grandfather's restaurant was, it's now a German restaurant called something like Glutz. I can't pronounce it in German, but it's just between 6th and 8th and Hennepin and Nicollet Mall, a few blocks from here. It's got great deep-fried walleye, if you're interested in that. Those of you who know the local fish here. Okay, we're going to move on. So because our family then moved to Chicago and then to Milwaukee, I didn't actually go to Minnesota, and chose University of Wisconsin. And there I studied a lot of different sciences. I knew I was interested in science, wasn't sure which science. And, you know, I remember being in a quantitative analysis lab with Dick Wolkowski, who was in the soils program. He says, you know, if you're not that happy, why don't you come over to soils and check us out? You know, it's a pretty good group to work with. And I came over and took some courses from J.R. Love and Corey and Schulte and all these guys, Peterson, before I left Wisconsin, and it really set me up to do graduate school. And I actually went into Dr. Walsh's office. He doesn't remember this, I'm sure. But I went in and talked to him a couple times because they adopted him as my informal advisor since I wasn't actually officially majoring in soils, but consulted him. And while he didn't offer me an assistantship, my grades were kind of but he did recommend me to go down to University of Missouri and work with Jim Brown because he knew my passion for both the soils and the plants, and that's where he was really situated with his scientific interest and his interest in botany and also in soil. So sent me down to Missouri, where I worked with the three B's, Blancher, Blevins, and Brown. Brown was my fertility advisor, and he really instilled the principles of soil fertility, classic fertility, and was a great mentor. And then Dale Blevins, I was asking him where he thought I should go. He said, well, you know, NC State, it's really got a good program. And if you work with this guy, Jackson, he's going to teach you a lot more than science. He's going to teach you about life, too. And he sure did. So amongst all those guys, I thought, wow, what great opportunity I had for great advising, great mentorship. And if I can just emulate what they gave me, I would be in good shape. So, position opens up at Washington State University. Oh, I should mention, so all of these departments were separate from the crops or plant sciences. Actually, Mizzou was agronomy, but they got divorced while I was there. And so all of them had separate soils departments. And I go up to Washington State, and there they've got a crop and soil science department, or agronomy and soils. And they actually had created my position because they thought they needed somebody that kind of had a foot in both areas that could kind of help bridge their programs. So it was a perfect situation for me, and I've been there ever since. And I suppose I could draw more arrows of exchanges of students and faculty back and forth between Washington State and Minnesota. H.H. Chang came from Washington State and ended up in Minnesota. Dave Mulla and Dave Huggins went there, but then we got him back, so there's been a lot of flow back and forth. Okay, so on to a little bit of the science and principles, and I thought I'd start here, and we all teach about the nutrient cycle, and there's thousands of images of the nutrient cycle, but I was looking at this the other day and thinking, Wu Xing, 2000 BC, you know, that sure looks like a nutrient cycle to me. And, you know, in the literature, in the soil science literature, we always credit Glauber for dreaming up this nutrient cycle. And he certainly measured it chemically. But the concept is right here, and this Wu Xing concept of five elements applies to lots of things, including supporting life, creation of life, you know, health and wellness and a number of different concepts. But I thought, you know, that really is a nutrient cycle when you think about the interactions of water, plants, trees, fire, earth, and metal. And then I went online just to see what the latest was on the internet, and here's the modern day nutrient cycle that you can find. I think it's probably the first one you pull up when you do a search for nutrient cycles, and it looks pretty much the same, although they don't put a circle around the rainfall up here. But if they did, the only thing they're missing is fire. And of course, we really recognize the role of fire in the nutrient cycle up out in the western states. And I was happy to see some sessions on the influence of fire and soil. So, it hasn't changed that much. It's a core principle of what we think about, and we need to keep that all in mind. Now, what about nutrient cycles and their scales? So we can first, when you look at those cycles, it automatically implies that, well, nutrients are cycling in place, and that's what undergraduates learn. And so here's one nutrient cycle in place that we've been studying and looking at silica uptake. And in our neck of the woods, we have wheat-dominated systems. Wheat. Not much else being grown. And so when we started thinking about, well, let's grow this oil crop, maybe for fuel or food, and Canada's doing lots of this and integrated it in their wheat system, why can't we do it? And we started thinking about the implications of this, of converting to a wheat-dominated system to some mixture of canola and wheat, and recognizing the fact that, well, there's a lot more silica taken up by the wheat than the canola, and what are the implications for that? So with harvest and then residue returns, you kind of envision that there'd be less silica cycling back to the soil surface over time. So what are the implications of that? So Taylor Beard asked the question, well, maybe you get more soil crusting. And she was a master's student that just finished up and moved to Tennessee. But the implications of soil crusting are pretty severe in our neck of the woods. Frank Young, who's done a lot of work on trying to establish canola in the hot, dry summer, knows this very well, that if you get a little bit of rain and crusting, that seedling's not going to be able to emerge. And so she did some work looking at adding silica and then looking at the history of cropping systems and looking for clues about this potential hypothesis, and indeed did find that, well, if you add more silica to soils, you do get thicker crusts forming, and then you can see these little crystals showing up on the clay particles with electron microscopy. And so the story is kind of coming together, I think, over time, if you think about the fact that, well, you cycle about a tenth to a quarter as much silica every time you grow canola compared to wheat. Maybe you could actually affect the biogeochemistry of the system. And so I think of Kent Keller when I think of this. Kent, we collaborated on some courses in the nitrogen program, and he's a great biogeochemist and thinker of cycles and mass conservation. So next scale of nutrient cycling would be regional cycling, and we don't have much of this. We have a little bit, and here's an example that was kind of rolled out by Sally Brown at University of Washington and Craig Cogger with WSU. Think about this system of returning biosolids from the Seattle urban area, Seattle-Portland corridor, back to eastern Washington onto wheat ground and maybe even canola ground now. And that would represent kind of a regional nutrient cycle of food and fertilizer. So fortunately, over a 20-year long-term experiment, long-term experiments are great, aren't they, for picking up long-term trends. And fortunately, he was wise enough to store the soil samples. So in the last couple of years leading up to his most recent retirement, Craig and I got together, and Craig offered me access to his archive samples. So we took those samples, and here's the one of the data slides that I have, where he had four treatments. He had anhydrous ammonia and block A, upper left, and then three levels of biosolids over time. Over 20 years, the biosolids were only applied every 4 years in a wheat fallow rotation. So the biosolids were basically feeding two wheat crops in a four-year wheat fallow rotation. And you can see that the anhydrous ammonia did a great job of feeding the wheat crop, and the nitrogen that was removed in the grain was measured, and most of what was applied was actually removed. And that kind of gets us into metrics of nutrient use efficiency. That was the topic of a symposium, and IPNI has been working on that. So those kind of ratios, and we'll look at those ratios a little bit more in the next few slides. But I also wanted to show you that even this conventional inorganic fertilizer was building a bit of soil organic matter. And some of that was actually non-hydrolyzable nitrogen, so the more recalcitrant nitrogen that's represented in parentheses down there. So a little bit of buildup of nitrogen, but mostly feeding the crop, as we all know commercial fertilizers are good at. And then as you go to this organic source, then you see a more balanced feeding of the crop and the soil. And then as you increase the rate, you get a little bit more grain in, but that starts to level off, and you can envision kind of this diminishing returns kind of Mitchell-like curve. And that then topped off with the last highest rate, but continued to feed that soil organic nitrogen and carbon pool, and continue to build up the recalcitrant nitrogen. Well, so we thought, oh, that's great. Organics are building that up and stimulating the microbes, and they're already making this recalcitrant carbon and nitrogen. But then we thought, well, let's just check this biosolids, and they only saved one sample from one of the applications, but they let us have that. And so we actually did the same kind of fractionation with that biosolids. And we found out that actually there's a lot of recalcitrant nitrogen and carbon in the material that you add. So people have probably already found this out in manure. It's certainly true in biosolids. And if you do the balance calculation, so we're into our mass balance general principle, you could actually justify concluding that, well, of all the non-hydrolyzable nitrogen that we've added, that could account for all of the recalcitrant nitrogen that's accumulating in the soil. So that's a different story, that, well, we're actually adding the recalcitrant nitrogen. But that's the sort of thing you can do when you're paying attention to this other law that I wanted to mention, which is mass balance. And so that's 17th century stuff by a Russian that I tried to practice his name, and I can't remember, but also Lavoisier applied it to chemical principles. And that's something we need to really think about when we're doing our advanced metrics of soil quality, to keep in mind that we can do these really simple mass balance calculations to try to figure out, well, where is the nitrogen going, or where is the phosphorus going? Do the inputs and outputs calculations that is being promoted with all the metrics that are going on right now, and IPNI has certainly done their share to look at global metrics of mass balances. So here's the story with carbon. People are more interested in carbon storage than nitrogen storage, but kind of the same message is that we're building up this non-hydrolyzable carbon fraction that is basically fed by the calcium carbon that we're adding as biosolids. So it's kind of a different story. And also building up that hydrolyzable, more reactive carbon at the same time. Another regional cycle that we've been working on probably for 20 years now, this concept of straw removal. We produce excessive amounts of straw, especially when people are trying to no-till and having difficulty planting back into that residue. And so kind of the most ironic system that evolved is no-till burning. So if you can imagine that you do the no-till to help the environment, but you have to burn the stubble to get rid of the stubble so you can actually do the mechanical operation of no-tilling and create all this smoke pollution. So maybe need to have better residue management, or better drills that can cut through that residue, or a lot of growers started removing their straw. And then there was a lot of concern for all the nutrients that were removed with the straw when they were harvesting the straw. And there's other markets for straw besides this particular concept. And it's an age-old concept that probably started in Egypt and China of using cereal straw for paper production. You know, we get so spoiled by using our pristine Douglas fir fibers, the long fibers that produce our beautiful paper. But they've been using lower quality fiber sources from crop straws to do this. And so it's a real simple procedure, just an alkali extraction of the cellulose. And then what you have left behind are all the other components of the straw, the lignin, hemicelluloses, carbohydrates and ash nutrients. And then we thought lately that, well, if you add a little bit of lime, which actually helps with the solubilization of the lime, the lignin does, reacts very interestingly, that you can put all that back onto eroded slopes of the same fields and kind of redistribute the carbon where it's needed. So that's been a concept for a long time. We're actually at the brink of actually having a commercial plant built in Eastern Washington that's going to start doing this, and they're looking at implementing this concept nationwide as well. So redistribution of carbon and nutrients is really the advantage from the soil fertility perspective of completing that cycle. Okay, so shifts in nutrient cycle. I want to get to the Magdoff model of the trophic pyramid. I love this diagram that I picked out of his article back in 97, been using it in my fertility class. And it really represents phases of agriculture and its effects on nutrient cycles. So you go from primitive agriculture on the left side and good tight cycling because you've got in place soil, plants, humans, and animals. And then as you start segmenting society, you've got humans moving to the cities, away from the food sources. It separates the human cycling of nutrients from cycling of animals and plants and soils. And then third step, which we've all experienced in different areas of our country, industrial and the world, industrial agriculture, where we separated the crop production from the animal production, and then also separated from the human consumption. So a lot of disjoint movement of nutrient cycles, which makes it harder to make that an efficient return. And so at this conference, we're talking a lot about, well, how much can we actually move back in the other direction? And I think we're certainly thinking about that in the Pacific Northwest, about to whatever extent we can do some crop livestock reintegration, somewhat similar to what's going on in the Great Plains right now. Okay, so let's go to the next scale of global nutrient cycling. In our neck of the woods, Pacific Northwest, over here, right here with the beautiful Palouse fields, and thinking about where the nitrogen came from and where it's going. Fertilizer nitrogen used to come down from Alaska. Now it's coming from South Mexico, Southern Gulf Coast, and then feeding our crops. And most of the wheat grain, actually, I kind of very optimistically said it was going to our west side population, but actually most of it has actually shipped overseas to Asian and Middle Eastern markets, about 90% actually. And so it's all consumed there, and then resulting sewage from all that consumption, they're on their own as far as enabling that nutrient cycle to happen. So we're out of control of that, and all we can really work on as agronomists and soil scientists is, well, we need to make sure that the nitrogen use is as efficient as we can as we export all that grain. So it's kind of an unsatisfactory feeling, but it's all we can do at this phase. So how do we do that? Well, maybe we supplement that fertilizer with other more internally cycled sources, but that requires the livestock crop integration, which we don't have right now. And then we can look at the nitrogen use efficiency. So I want to talk a little about these efficiency metrics. You know, there was a big symposium on this, and Dr. Ty Maas, who just graduated in our program now doing a postdoc, has done her own review of the literature, and this has also been done by Drinkwater and Fixin earlier. One other one I can't remember right now. But anyway, she came up with about 13 different definitions of nitrogen use deficiency. So obviously, the society has not done its job in standardizing this terminology, which has been the source of a lot of confusion, just having all these different definitions. So when you read these papers, you really have to get down to what are they actually using for their definition of nitrogen use efficiency in their components. And then the other offshoot of all of this is that somewhat dire reports of poor fertilizer nitrogen use uptake efficiencies has really led to environmental models that you see in the literature and talked about, even in the popular press, that actually represent little or no nitrogen cycling. So this kind of bothered me, especially in the Pacific Northwest, and maybe this is happening in some systems where you just account for any fertilizer that's not used that particular year goes into the environment. But we see a lot of cycling that's utilizing that fertilizer. So I'll show you the best example I can come up with to illustrate this. So we did an N15 study on winter wheat. It's probably one of these studies that Peter mentioned that he started looking at the timing of nitrogen fertilizer in winter wheat, labeled with N15 fertilizer, and then just doing the mass balance calculation of where the other nitrogen had to have come from that wasn't in the fertilizer, and we ended up coming up with this kind of a graph showing the overall curve showing total nitrogen accumulation in the above ground plant, and then we measured this much coming from fertilizer and that left this much coming from the soil. And no matter what we did, whether we did it, put it all in the fall or split it fall and spring, that was a little bit better efficiency. But basically, we came up with the same kind of numbers that everybody else was coming out. Wow, we're only getting like 20 to 40% nitrogen fertilizer recovery. And so we started saying this a lot. And it helped with our grant proposals. We were all doing it. And the world is ending because we're losing all this fertilizer nitrogen. But then you have to ask the question, well, if I do the mass balance and this is coming and a lot of the nitrogen is coming from the soil itself, where does that nitrogen come from? Well, it's either going come from the degrading soil organic matter, which actually a lot of studies had shown that it wasn't degrading, so you're maintaining that level. So it couldn't have been degrading of organic matter, and organic matter losses were coming more from erosion than anything else in well-fertilized intensive systems. Or it's actually coming from nitrogen cycling. And so that was our conclusion, that this was coming from residual fertilizer from previous years or nitrogen that cycled into the organic pool and then was recycling out to become available to this particular crop. Okay, so and then when we actually looked at available nitrogen, which was a term that Dr. Huggins developed when he was a graduate student at WSU, looking at plant nitrogen accumulated per unit of actual available nitrogen in the soil profile over the course of the season, that was a much better message, or at least a more hopeful message that, well, we are recovering 78% of what's actually available there rather than the 20 to 40% fertilizer recovery. Okay, well, that got us all into this morass of nitrogen use efficiency terms, and layered on top of that was the use of kind of the universal use, or at least in the U.S., of this concept called unit nitrogen requirement. It's around one for 1 pound of nitrogen per bushel of corn. Is that about what it is? And it kind of varies up and down. And then in our world, it's 2.7 pounds of nitrogen supply per bushel of wheat. And that's been used forever. I went back into the old extension literature, and it started in the 50s. I think with Glenn Leggett and a couple others, they were estimating in the 2.4 to 2.7 pounds of nitrogen per bushel. And then having come from NC State and that great interdisciplinary group of Moll, Campeth, and Jackson looking at genotypic nitrogen use efficiency in prolific corn, they created this term, nitrogen use efficiency, as grain weight per, they said total nitrogen supply, but they used as a surrogate and fertilizer. And I always kind of wondered about that because we never really did much soil sampling. And they just said, well, coastal plain soils, we're getting so much rain, we can't really measure it in the soil. So I just believed them, and we started using fertilizer nitrogen as the denominator. And they were probably right. But in spirit, they really wanted to put total nitrogen supply in that denominator. And then the first two components that they broke out from that was uptake efficiency and what they called utilization efficiency. And when you multiply those all together and do unit cancellations, it comes out to grain weight per nitrogen supply. Looking at uptake efficiency of plant nitrogen over nitrogen supply times nitrogen utilization, grain weight per unit of nitrogen in the plant. And I've been told by Jim Camerato now that it's internal nitrogen efficiency is the term for that, same term. So we're still making up new terms for these things, proliferating new terms. And then, Dave Huggins in 93 as a PhD student, he started looking at this stuff and said, well, let's take that Leggett definition of N supply and use it in this NUE definition instead of fertilizer nitrogen. And then use that component analysis to expand. And the use of this component analysis, then you can start to attribute factors contributing to nitrogen use efficiency from these components that kind of relate to physiological processes. So uptake efficiency, root efficiency, and then utilization efficiency. How well does the plant then make grain for a given amount of nitrogen in the plant? So that went forward, and I apologize for not having time to cite everybody else. There's been lots of people that have looked at various aspects of all this, and all I have time is to tell you our trail of this. But then in 95 or so, we, as Peter mentioned, we started looking at variable landscapes, and this had almost become a law, that this UNR figure had almost become a law in making nitrogen recommendations in eastern Washington and actually in the whole Pacific Northwest. And when Tim Fees, working with Baird Miller and myself, started looking at these UNRs over the landscape, we thought, oh my gosh, they're not at all different when we started looking at just nitrogen rate experiments over the landscape. So we decided that regionally developed UNRs cannot be applied at a site-specific level because they weren't really developed that way. They were averages over the whole region, and usually they were running these experiments on fairly nice ground, right? They didn't want to trek halfway. You know, if you've seen some slides of the Palouse, you know, they couldn't put plots up on the hill slopes where it was at a 30% angle. So it really, the original work was done on certain landscapes. So that work has all moved forward. Lots of people have been looking at site-specific nitrogen management. I saw a beautiful paper presented today on moving this forward and using crop soil models to make more accurate predictions of all this. And then thinking about more rotational stuff, though, all that stuff, single crop, and about the mid-90s, as far as I can tell, people started thinking, well, what about nitrogen use efficiency of the rotations? And we certainly weren't the first to think about all that, but we applied that in the Columbia Basin, where they were losing a lot of nitrogen, and people were getting pretty upset because their well water was starting to rise with nitrate in the drinking water. And so I had a student, Tom Weinert, who decided, well, you know, I'd like to look at this cover crop business. And there had been a lot of cover crop work done in other parts of the country, and we decided to apply it in this pretty intensive irrigated sweet corn potato rotation. And And it turned out that, contrary to what you would think, that most of the nitrogen was being lost outside of the irrigation season. So if you do a good job of water management, you just have to watch out for what's going on during the non-cropping season, normal summer crop season. And even in a 4-inch rainfall, you know, this is a desert in central Washington, nobody really thought there'd be much leaching, but since all of the precipitation was concentrated in the wintertime, that was enough to push that nitrogen down below the fairly shallow root zone of some of these crops like potatoes. You go down to 60 centimeters and that's it. So there was enough leaching to lose it out of the root profile. And so it was really surprising that, especially after sweet corn, and I characterize this as, you know, fresh sweet corn, you pick it while the crop is still fresh and you leave all that fresh residue behind. And I've characterized it as being kind of a really badly timed cover crop because you return all that green residue right at the time you don't want to return it to soil. And it's still got the fall and the winter to incubate where there's no crop growing. So these cover crops were a great solution to that. And we found that we could recover lots of nitrogen in this warm environment where we grow good biomass and produce a lot of, or take up a lot of nitrogen. And we found we could actually recover more than 100 kilograms per hectare in this really low precipitation region that would have otherwise been lost over the wintertime. So I thought that was pretty cool and kind of got us on to looking at more rotational nitrogen use efficiency, which has been carried on by Ty Maas now, and she's also incorporated this interaction between nitrogen and water. So a merger of ideas. You know, you take the history, you got to look at the history, look at where these UNRs come from, then we merged it with the Moll, Camperth, and Jackson nutrient use efficiency. And lo and behold, if you flip UNR upside down, it's NUE. I thought, oh, well, that's pretty cool. So we can directly relate the nitrogen use efficiency component analysis to making recommendations based on these time-old UNRs. Okay, and so we took that concept of recognizing that they were the inverse and then applied them to our next law, which is the law of diminishing returns. And we honor that law as something that happens time and time and time again with soil fertility trials, that you have this diminishing returns response to nutrients that are supplied to a plant. So Dr. Maas was particularly interested in looking at the interaction between nutrients and water, because that obviously is the big question mark now with climate change, and we had a great setting in the eastern Washington to study this over different sites and site years. And so we combine those two concepts, and Ty Maas and Ashley Hammack, along with Rich Koenig and Vicky McCracken, we've got a manuscript being reviewed now. And these are the equations. You all know the Mitscherlich equation, just relating grain yield with nutrient supply, in this case nitrogen. Exponential rise to the maximum, basically, if you look at sigma plot or R or whatever program you're looking at. And now looking at, well, what are the interactions between nitrogen and water? And a recent paper by Harmson and Mitscherlich, which Ty found was particularly useful in combining these two factors. And so when we did that, we found some good equation that would kind of represent the variation that we received over site years. So these are the kind of data that we were getting and matching up to the modeled response curves. Now the key here is that we actually mapped on the x-axis not fertilizer nitrogen but nitrogen supply. And really the reviewers said, well, you really can't do that in a specific site year because, well, all you have is a flat line response to fertilizer. And then, strictly speaking, yes, we can't really say that this is a significant model because there's no data down here. But we kept saying, well, but the truth of the matter is, you know, if we had 100 observations of zero nitrogen, I bet we'd have 100 observations of zero grain yield. So I think that helps to justify it. And then when we fill that curve in with other data from other years, we kind of get the composite view of that. So integrated data over site years to generate the model and then apply them back to the site years. So I wanted to show you where we are right now, which is with increasing water, we have increasing yields. This is for spring canola. And these are the kind of curves that we get. And this, if you've studied the classics, this is a classic Mitscherlich response to two variables, that the grain yield is responding to both variables at the same time. And what that results in then is when you plot the UNRs at an economically optimized rate or amount of supply and yield, that the UNRs actually shift from very high at low yields to relatively low and much better at high yields. So if you then flip that upside down and think in terms of nitrogen use efficiency, the nitrogen use efficiency is increasing with higher yields. So that was quite a revelation. And when we're thinking about the what we've done with wheat all of these years is just assuming that it's a constant number. And 2.7 is a number, so it really represents more of a Liebig type of relationship. Okay, so I better move on. That got us into some component analysis, and if you happen to see Ty Maz's presentation, there's a lot we can do with component analysis. Basically, I use this to transition to some of the root stuff that we're doing and to recognize that uptake efficiency is a big part of nitrogen use efficiency, even in this data set, about half or so. And we can see that with water and nitrogen extraction. So here's a plot of water extraction over time of winter canola planted right here. We got this much water. It starts drawing it down. And then over the winter, we get recharge with the green line, and then harvest, it goes down to this. And Megan Reese on the project was diligent enough to take the samples and run the water potentials and define the permanent wilting point, which is right here, and you say, okay, well, the crop didn't do real well down here. So there's some root restriction that's keeping that water from being used, or the crop from using that water. So then you can look at, well, eventually we've got to go underground. And so here's our crew with some really bright undergrad interns, one of them, one of these dreamer students that we got from the East Coast, Mexican immigrant family. She was just incredible. Just incredible worker and thinker, and she was just like a sponge for, she didn't know anything about soil science, and by the time we finished her in her 9-week session, she was doing GIS maps of this data, which I'll show you. And so with the help of Isaac Mattson, she generated these maps of roots that were sticking out of the soil pit face. And you can see differences between these two sites. Pomeroy is a wet site, Okanagan is a dry site. And these sites were all set up by Frank Young, who's our ambassador to the growers and field warrior. And so we got to recognize that without his help to get access to these fields, we wouldn't have been able to do this work. So differences in rooting. And we started looking at restrictions, and we saw definite physical restrictions occurring. So, you know, the soil physics people have a lot to contribute to our fertility work because it affects our roots. And here's a syndrome that we're actually seeing a lot of across eastern Washington, this J-hooking. So canola's got a taproot system. It's supposed to grow straight down, and yet it's going down and then turning sideways because of these restrictions. And we're seeing a lot of that due to compacted layers. Okay. I've got another whole section. Okay. So, real quick, root measurements, you know, over my lifespan, we've gone from the ruler to this core pit intersection, line intersection method, which at least got us out of measuring it by ruler, and then digital analysis. And we did some work on digital analysis and had some really interesting geometrical challenges to try to figure this out. Some of these early systems were actually measuring the total length of these edges, and you can see they're jagged. But those, we know that those aren't how roots look. They're not jagged. It's just because these pixels are square. And so when people were counting up the lengths of the edges, that wasn't good. And even taking the hypotenuse of these wasn't necessarily good. And so we figured out combining groups of these images and then taking the hypotenuse of groups of images was much better. And so we published that, which we thought was a pretty good contribution. A lot of people picked this up. And we actually beat the health profession, who was using some of the older algorithms in measuring veins of people's scanned images of skin. And so I'm going to go past that. And so we've gone basically now for imaging, we've gone from rhizotrons to mini rhizotrons to glass face images to 3D tomography now, which is going to be real fascinating. And we were kind of stuck in this era of doing root scanning, but our contribution was developing a poor man's mini rhizotron by using these real cheap office scanners. And right now they're going for less than $100 a piece. And they have beautiful resolution, like 3,600 dots per inch, which gets you down to root hair level. So you can watch the root hairs grow in time. And you just have to seal them with some bathroom caulk and sink them in the soil and grow the roots along them. Well, of course, you know, the bad side of that is you wreck a lot of scanners because not all of them are sealed right. But they're cheap, and it keeps Hewlett-Packard and Canon in business. So Ashley Hammock, who's here, did a lot of cool work looking at the growth of root hairs relative to the distance of the apex in response to soil water. Looked at different varieties, and it was really cool to see the differences amongst species. And then Isaac, we started looking at ammonium toxicity, or ammonia toxicity, ammonia gas. And we first started thinking that it's more ammonia gas in this chicken manure. Everybody in fertility knows it's real hot for ammonium. But we saw the toxic layer very high above the band of manure. So we thought, well, there's no way that ammonium ions are migrating that far. It's got to be the ammonia gas, and we verified that with pH changes, where the ammonia gas was actually acting like a lime and increasing the pH. And so then we thought, well, maybe that's going on with fertilizers too. And here's a root of canola over time that Isaac just created just in the last couple of weeks for you. Down about here is the fertilizer band, and you can see the root tip stopping right here and then desiccating and shrinking, and the shrinkage progresses up all this way, and because the cytokinins are no longer being produced in the apex, the plant starts making ladder roots like crazy, and then the ladder roots die because they're not supported by the xylem coming down from the shoot. So So really cool stuff. So I think in the future, I'm getting close to the end now, future thoughts. We've got a new generation of soil scientists, and they just want to be able to touch and dig in the soil. You know, you can't keep them just doing large data set analytics. You get them out in the soil, let them see what it's all about. They love that stuff. And we're too old to do that, so it's a great fit. But, you know, I was thinking about all the monolith collections around the country and probably around the world, and most of them really don't feature roots in them. Some of them do, but in our monolith collection, just a few monoliths actually have roots. So we focused on capturing the roots along with the monoliths, and Terry Tindall told me that there's a beautiful display of root monoliths, or at least roots, in the Smithsonian right now. Climate change, well, it's all about the water, stupid. Well, I guess Jerry Hatfield convinced me it's temperature and water. But with respect to nutrient management, it's certainly about the water. Looking at recommendations and water influences on those recommendations over years and over locations. And then if you look at the most recent soil plant nutrient and root growth models, really poor in looking at the water interaction and how it affects nutrient uptake and root growth models. A few efforts along those lines, but not nearly enough. And then extending that to the cropping systems and water influences, and looking for the elusive G by E by M, genotype by environment by management. Okay, so I just asked the new generation to carry on, protect the land grant mission, because that's where we all got started. We ought to have a land grant index. Everybody's creating indices these days. So what percentage of your career in academics was with a land grant institution? It's the only thing I could think of to create that I'm actually on the top. I got to be on the top 100%. But you can all think of that and think about how important that's been for the development of our country. Those of you who've done some international work, you all know this is the absolute model that people want to aspire to. Connecting the research with the outreach and the education all in one house and integrating it. So I'll return to this. The name of our group is Nutrient Cycling Rises Through Ecology. We added analytics because big data, everybody's talking about it. Technology, you got to look for the latest technology and weave in the education. And so, have I had any fun? Things I haven't talked about. Just all the great communities and colleagues beyond what I've mentioned here, the students, all of you. And then, of course, all the memorable moments like being knee-high or even deeper in a manure lagoon without waders. I remember that. I mean, that's got to be on your bucket list as a soil fertility. Everybody's got to do a manure study, right? And then go into the local restaurant and try to get service. And I didn't purposely list these in one and two, but they're not related. Underneath the floating green at Coeur d'Alene, I don't know how many of you know the golf course at Coeur d'Alene. It's got a floating green on a big cement boat, and you got to hit it out there. They move it in and out, 110 to 200 yards. And you got to hit that thing. Well, Bill Johnston thought of the idea of using that as the world's biggest lysimeter. What a great thought, because they collect all the water, the leachate down below. He set up some monitors down there, and he invited me to collaborate on the nitrate, and we were actually climbed underneath that floating green. I remember being kissed by an Iraqi extension specialist, and it was just such a surprise. I just said, what's it? But we took a group of Iraqis, and it was right after the fall of Saddam, and they were just glad to get out of the country, but just so happy to talk about agriculture and not so much about the war, and to see the agriculture. It was their first trip out of the country, and we brought them to Central Washington and showed them the really advanced center pivot systems. He just was just so joyful. He came up and gave me a big hug and a kiss. I've been able to, you know, that's the great thing about being in agriculture. It's like, okay, there's soils and there's food production all over the world. You can do as much international stuff as you want. I've seen the wonders of the world, the pyramids in Egypt and Mexico and the Great Wall and all that stuff. And all the people affiliated with are just terrific, and they're just people, you know, just like you and I. And then over time, been able to witness those great historic changes that have happened in Asia and Europe, and it's just been phenomenal. So I wish the young people well. It's a great career to be in, and when it's all said and done, this is it. This is it. Life, death, and soil fertility. So thank you for listening.